calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Welcome to the Tom Hartman radio program. We just 20, 30 minutes ago, half hour ago, thereabouts, on the local show that I do on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington, just interviewed George Galloway. We were originally going to interview him on the national show, and he had to leave at this moment, this particular point in time. He had to be traveling. And so he said, can you interview me an hour earlier? And so we did. And so we interviewed him on the local show, and we recorded it, and I am going to play it now. So without further ado, George Galloway, the fellow who cleaned Norm Coleman's clock on the floor of the United States Senate, and we actually discussed that with him as well. Mr. George Galloway just reelected to the House of Parliament, the House of Commons. And part of Parliament in the United Kingdom.
Thanks so much, Mr. Galloway, for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
First of all, my apologies if I have your title wrong. I'm calling you Mr. Is that how...
No, Mr. is more than adequate.
Okay. I'm wondering, what is your opinion on the legality of Guantanamo Bay, and what do you think about the construction of a death chamber there, which was reported by the BBC yesterday?
Well, it's an utterly illegal process which is being followed. People are being taken, in some cases, from third countries. One of the British citizens, for example, was taken from the Gambia. Others have been taken from Pakistan. Others still from Afghanistan. They're taken by force, drugs forcibly injected into them, hooded, chained, and taken to a cage in the tropics where, by all accounts, they're being kept in conditions that you wouldn't keep a dog in your country or mine, and if you did, you'd be had up for cruelty by the authorities. And then there's very clear evidence of systematic torture. There's the desecration of the Quran, which may or may not have happened, depending on which edition of Newsweek you are prepared to believe. This is a big scar on the face of the United States, and it seems to me that too few citizens of the United States have fastened on to the fact that the protestations by your president and your government of being interested in human rights and democracy and freedom are quite negated by the very existence of Guantanamo Bay. But of course, that's not the end of it. Bagram Air Base is exactly the same kind of place. Abu Ghraib prison, well, we perhaps on a family show shouldn't probe too deeply into the disgusting obscenities that were going on there. And it turns out that where the United States itself is not prepared to physically torture people, it merely subcontracts out the task, sending people to the likes of Uzbekistan and Egypt and other prison states where less squeamish governments will torture people for the United States and give the U.S. the testimony they get as a result, which, of course, it goes without saying, is almost never of any use because anyone will say anything under torture.
Yes.
And all sorts of wild goose chases are no doubt embarked upon as a result of all this. So I'm afraid Guantanamo is a blot on the landscape, and the fact that the United States occupies it in Cuba without Cuba's agreement is just the icing on the cake.
Yeah. George Galloway, a member of Parliament in Great Britain, of the House of Commons. Why do you believe that Tony Blair decided to join President Bush in waging war when, as has recently emerged with this Downing Street memo, he knew that the case was flimsy? And do you think that either Blair or Bush or people in their administration should be prosecuted on any level for this activity?
Well, first of all, I'm sure that they will not be prosecuted because it's only losers that are prosecuted. In the international system that we have, there's no chance of the likes of Henry Kissinger, for example, the greatest living war criminal in the world today, with the blood of millions of people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Chile and East Timor and many other places on his hands. He will never appear in a court or be behind bars. That's for the tin pot tyrants, the tiny tyrants like Milosevic. They get sent there. The big tyrants never face justice. I wish I knew the answer to your first question. Why did Tony Blair join it? Certainly, it's been utterly ruinous to his political reputation. He will be followed into the history books and into the grave with this mark of Cain on his forehead. He will be remembered for nothing other than that he followed George W. Bush over a cliff, took the rest of us with them, and we haven't yet reached the bottom, I'm afraid. All I can say from my own conversations with Mr. Blair, man to man, are that I think that both him and George W. Bush are possessed of a kind of messianic belief that somebody, God perhaps, gave them the job of shouldering the white man's burden, which is the world, that someone gave them the right to step outside of international law, go anywhere, do anything, pay any price in other people's blood, to reshape the world in their image, in the image that they want to see. And I think that both men will be damned in history. Both men have made their respective countries the two most hated countries in the world. They have endangered the lives and safety of our citizens. They have damaged our economic and cultural and social interests. And they should face prosecution, but never will.
Yeah. Mr. Galloway, you called for a police inquiry into ballot fraud and ghost voting in Bethnal Green and Bow. In America now, we just have this just recently released. Congressman John Conyers went to Ohio and held hearings, 13 or 12 members of Congress, several weeks of hearings under oath, and determined that there was considerable election fraud in this last election where George Bush became president. And, of course, we know now that, in fact, it was first reported on the BBC. Americans didn't know it, but folks in the U.K. knew within weeks of the 2000 election that George Bush's brother Jeb and Kathleen Harris in Florida had conspired to remove the names of tens of thousands of legally registered African Americans, largely Democratic voters, from the rolls there in Florida. What do you think is the solution to making elections, both in the United States and the United Kingdom, and around the world for that matter, open, fair, and accurate?
Well, you know, we're used to sending observers to third world countries and former banana republics to observe their elections. But the British election recently and your election just a little more distantly, and the one in 2000 for that matter, really, if they had been observed by third world observers, would have been declared bogus and deeply flawed. Your president stole the presidency in Florida using his brother and his brother's close friends to cheat the people of the United States out of their freely elected president, who was undoubtedly Al Gore, even if you only counted the votes that actually made it through the hoops in order to be cast. The president was really Al Gore. And in Ohio, and I've read the stuff that Congressman Conyers is doing, and I commend it. It's clear enough on the face of it that there was substantial fraud in that state, and thus delivering the Electoral College vote for President Bush. In our country, the government have vastly inflated the number of people voting by post, which, as the courts have found, is wide open to electoral fraud. And electoral fraud there has been. I don't need to deal with the allegations, which are in their thousands. I can just deal with the cases that have already been dealt with. Six new Labour councillors were struck off and thrown out of the council in Birmingham, which is Britain's second city, having been caught red-handed in a room around a table at the dead of night, at midnight, with thousands, and I mean thousands, of other people's ballot papers that they were happily filling in. And they are now facing criminal prosecution as a result. Another new Labour councillor in the town of Blackburn, where the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw represents, and he was a close associate of Jack Straw, and he was a 65 or 67-year-old man, has just been sent to prison for 3.5 years for having been caught red-handed doing exactly the same thing. When you add the thousands of allegations that there now are of voter fraud in the last election, then I've called for the police to move in en masse, because we are heading down the road towards a kind of corruption that we never thought we'd see. Perhaps it's an innate sense of democratic superiority on our part. We used to think that that kind of ballot rigging and voter fraud was something that happened in other countries, not in the mother of democracies, Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was a vote by mail problems that you're having in the UK. Here in Oregon, we have the only vote by mail system in the state, and I think we've always thought that it was impregnable. It was immune.
Well, yours may be. Ours is very far from that. And when the electoral rolls are in the state that they're in my own constituency, for example, there were no less than 14 voters registered in one flat in Brick Lane, which is a heavily Asian Bengali area, Bangladeshi area in my constituency. And when we went there, not only were there not 14 voters living there, which would have been odd in any case given the size of the apartments, but there were no voters living there. Indeed, there was no one living there. It was utterly derelict. Now, somebody registered them and many hundreds, maybe even thousands of others, for votes that they would cast by post, who simply didn't exist. And of course, the scam is that someone picks up the ballot papers when they're posted out by the authority, fills them in, and returns them.
Yeah. George Galloway, a member of the Parliament, a member of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, what lessons have you learned, if I can change the topic just for a moment, to economics? And then if you have another moment, I'd like to get back to the loss of freedoms in the wake of 9/11. But I'm curious about privatization in the UK. It's all the rage in the United States. I was over there when you were privatizing your railroads. Could you speak to the citizens of America about the dangers of privatization, please?
Well, what a way to run a railroad. That's what most people in the country are saying now. And how's this for a turnaround? British Rail, which was owned by the state, which was a nationalised railway, was probably the least loved institution in the United Kingdom when Mrs. Thatcher privatised it. Now, fully 80% of the people of the country, 88.0% of the people of the country, want the railways taken back into public ownership, because they realise now that we're paying three times the subsidy to the private owners of the privatized railways that we were paying to the nationalized railways. And we've got a dirtier, more dangerous, and more expensive service as a result. It takes longer now to go from London to Birmingham on the train than it does to go from where I'm sitting in the House of Commons to the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And it's only 110 miles. From London to Birmingham. We've had a whole series of railway disasters caused by people cutting corners to save costs, to make more profits. We've had delays that would make your hair stand on end, people in the depths of winter being delayed 5-7 hours on railway journeys. And we have rolling stock, which has not improved since the public sector days. All that's happening is that we're giving huge state subsidies to private owners who are putting it in their pockets.
Yeah.
Now, we are the only country in the whole world that privatized our air traffic control space. Even the United States did not do that.
We're talking about it here.
Yes, you're talking about it. Mr. Blair was ahead of you. He was ahead of Mrs. Thatcher, who wouldn't have dreamt of any such reckless measure. And we've now handed over control of our air traffic control space to people whose primary responsibility, whose very legal and fiduciary duty, is to use their investment to make a profit for their shareholders.
And we'll get back to more of George Galloway. My interview with George Galloway, Member of Parliament, the United Kingdom, member of the House of Commons, just re-elected, the fellow who cleaned Norm Coleman's clock before the United States Senate. Mr. Coleman now having purged that testimony from the website of the United States Senate. Right after this, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus pocus. Yeah, misdirected them.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Back to our interview with George Galloway, Member of Parliament of the United Kingdom, the fellow who cleaned the clock of Senator, Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman before the United States Senate quite recently.
That's got to be legally their first priority.
By the way, I just paused it. He was speaking about privatization, and in fact, speaking of privatization, and we're going to be playing parts of this interview through the second and third hour of the program because it runs longer than I have just in this first half hour. In the second half hour of this first hour program, we're going to be debating a leading proponent of privatization, and in fact, this guy even says we should not have antitrust laws in the United States. Stick around; that should be entertaining at the bottom of the hour. Back to George Galloway.
Make a profit for their shareholders now. Just like an equally deadly privatization, though it doesn't sound like it, it might sound banal. When we privatized the cleaning services in hospitals, we immediately passed on to companies a duty not primarily to keep the hospitals clean, but primarily to make a profit for their shareholders. The result has been an explosion, a veritable explosion in reinfection rates, so-called MRSA, which is a kind of superbug mutant,
right. Yeah.
Which is actually killing 10,000 people a year in Britain. And there are many hospitals, including the one in my own constituency, miscalled the Royal London Hospital, though you'd never find a member of the royal family in it, I can assure you, where you're as likely to come out sick as you are to come out cured because the state of the cleaning services in the hospitals. And that's directly linked to the privatization of that service. So I say to the people of the United States that the rest of the world is falling out of love with privatization. Some things are too important to be left to the private sector. And just as some things are too important or specialized to be left to the public sector. Nobody's saying that every cafe or fish and chip shop on the corner should be owned by the state. That would be absurd. But there are some things, like air traffic control, like national railway networks, like the cleaning of hospitals, like the teaching of our children in schools, which are too important to be left to people who are doing it for profit.
Well said. And in fact, Senator Bill Frist, the fellow who's leading the United States Senate now, his family fortune was built on hospitals, previously public hospitals being made private. And we're seeing the consequences of that in the United States, exploding health care costs and other
yes.
problems.
Well, we say here, it might be a little unfair, we say here, if you fall down in the street in the United States, the ambulance man must feel for your wallet before he feels for your pulse.
Yeah, and to some extent it actually is true. Well, my last question for you is sort of a two-part here. I know you have to get back to the work that you're doing, and I very much appreciate your spending this time with us, sir.
Oh, you're welcome.
First of all, Senator Norm Coleman, whose committee you testified before and to whom you spoke the week before last, as I recall, or last week recently, there are reports, which I've been unable to absolutely confirm, but apparently from the searches of the Senate website, it looks like your testimony has disappeared from the Senate record.
That's right.
Do you know about that, and what are your thoughts on that?
It has been airbrushed from the record. In a way, if you saw the testimony, you'll know why. Because what I managed to do, and I thank God for the breath that he gave me to do it, was blow away the smokescreen that these people are trying to throw up to divert attention from the very real crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors that they themselves are responsible for. And I've had, and I'm not exaggerating this, more than 12,000 emails from the United States. 12,000 emails. And it's not easy in the United States to find out the email address of a British parliamentarian.
Yeah. So George Galloway getting a lot of feedback. We'll be back with more of his interview in the second hour of our program. This is Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news, the last bastion of democracy, the Tom Hartman radio program. Next, we're going to be talking about privatization. Something near and dear to George Galloway's heart. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's never too late to start all over again.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you.
Let's just wrap up this interview with George Galloway here before we go on to Gary Hall. I'd just like to summarize it. George Galloway was speaking. You've been listening here.
And these people have all written to me. Many of them have drawn.
We're talking, by the way, about Americans who contacted him. How does he feel about the fact that Norm Coleman pulled off the Senate website his testimony before the United States Senate?
Attention to the fact that although for one day, just 24 hours, my testimony was on the website, it has now been wiped off it. And that tells you all you need to know, really, about the quality of the commitment to democracy and open government that these people really have, as opposed to the talk that they talk.
Well, and finally, with regard to democracy, what do you see the problem with the new laws we're debating, enhancing, actually, the so-called Patriot Act here in the United States? I know you have these kinds of things going on in the UK. The curtailment of freedoms, the loss of liberties in the wake of 9/11. I'm assuming that you've probably seen the Power of Nightmares, the BBC documentary, which nobody in the United States has seen. Do you think that these changes are necessary or useful, or what's your opinion of this?
Well, I'm afraid I'm an advocate of the great Dr. Johnson, the English man of letters, who said that patriotism was the last refuge of the scoundrel. He didn't mean, of course, the patriotism which is a noble, genuine love for what's best about your country and its beauty and its achievements and so on. But those who wrap themselves in flags and blow the tinny trumpet of patriotism as a means of fooling the people, as a means of getting them to fall in behind the colors and march off to ignoble wars. Wars of conquest, wars of aggression, wars for exploitation. And that's what I think this Patriot Act is all about. It's about fooling the American people into believing that if you just arm the state with enough fly swats, you'll be able to whack away all the beasts that are coming your way. But if the truth is, these mosquitoes are coming out of a swamp, a very real swamp of grievance, of bitterness and hatred at our injustice and at the policies that we are following. And unless we drain that swamp by reversing the policies of injustice that have germinated this threat, then it doesn't matter how many Patriot Acts you pass, doesn't matter how many fly swats you hand out, how many mosquito nets you wrap yourself in, you're not going to be able to stop them hurting us again.
Yeah, well said. Mr. George Galloway, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
I do appreciate it. I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much. George Galloway, Member of Parliament, the United Kingdom, recently testifying before the United States Senate. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, still with you. I mean, you were listening to me interview Mr. Galloway. It's not congressman. I guess it's just Mr. In the United Kingdom. Let's talk about trust. Speaking of Galloway's comments, I thought it was fascinating, his comments on privatization and economic issues. The American Brass Association, this is back in the 1880s, came out and said in their statement of purpose that their purpose in organizing was, quote, to meet and end ruinous competition, that is, to stop competition, end quote. Similar language is found in the charters, articles, or publications of trade groups that organize to protect large companies in business categories as diverse as selling cotton, manufacturing matches, and distributing steel. To deal with this excessive competition, companies joined together within industries to fix prices and control markets. By 1889, there were at least 50 of these consortiums in the United States. They were referred to as trusts. In the 6 years since its creation in 1882, John Rockefeller's Standard Oil Trust increased its holdings to over $50 million, which is big money back then. And the result was that the trust destroyed thousands of small oil and kerosene dealers, putting them out of business. The Sugar Trust also had caused the price of sugar to soar nationally. The Bagging Trust had doubled the price of bags in a decade. Copper Trust succeeded in raising the cost of copper from 12 to 17 cents a pound. A small businessman named Harlan Dowd testified before the United States Congress in 1889, that when he tried to market kerosene in West Virginia in competition with John Rockefeller's Standard Oil Trust, the railroads raised their prices to him for transporting his product. They were colluding with Standard Oil. He tried to survive by shipping his kerosene in his own horse-drawn wagon, but in response to this, the Standard Oil Trust cut their price to consumers for kerosene in the areas where Dow was trying to sell it. He told the Senate Investigating Committee, "I stopped the wagon, and it's been idle in the stable ever since." One of Standard Oil's distributors, a man named F.D. Carley, even corroborated Dow's testimony, bragging about how he'd been able to destroy every small competitor who tried to enter the marketplace on behalf of Standard Oil or stay in the business. For instance, Carley said, a man named Pettit got some oil tanks in New Orleans. I dropped the price on him pretty lively. In the absence of competition and free choice, giant corporations have the power to do this, and history shows that traditionally they have. By the way, with regard to George Galloway's testimony, a number of people calling about that, we will have it on our website by tonight, the entire piece, and we will be replaying pieces of it as we go through the next 3 hours of the program and on the air tomorrow as well. So no need to call about that. We will get it up. The interview was just a half hour ago. We haven't had a chance to get to it. Gary Hall is with us. Gary writes for the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, and Gary is of the opinion, well, actually, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Gary. What do you think about antitrust laws?
I think everything you just said is wrong, and that if you continue that line of reasoning consistently, you'd have to bemoan the fact that Tiger Woods wins so many golf tournaments and bests his competition, and it's unfair that Barry Bonds wins so many MVPs and Michael Jordan won so many championships. On a free market, businessmen get better and beat their competition by being more productive, more efficient, more able at creating wealth. That's actually supposed to be the American way. Those who are best succeed the most.
But I don't believe that Tiger Woods has ever been accused of trying to keep somebody out of a tournament.
No, it's by dint of his magnificent talent.
Right.
That he keeps other people from holding up the winning cup at the end of the tournament.
But what John Rockefeller did with the Standard Oil Trust is he cut a deal with the railroads where they would refuse to carry the oil or kerosene of any of his competitors.
Sure. What's wrong with that? When Tiger Woods agrees with his caddy that only that caddy will carry his bags, that, quote, excludes other people from being able to be Tiger Woods' caddy. That's in the nature of a contract. I mean, Mr. Hartman, I don't know. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
It's the same thing. That's an exclusive arrangement.
My exclusive arrangement with my wife and Tiger Woods' exclusive arrangement with his caddy, my arrangement with Louise doesn't prevent other people from marrying other women, and Tiger Woods' caddy doesn't prevent Tiger Woods or doesn't prevent other people from playing golf.
You're exactly
John
right.
Rockefeller prevented other people from entering the oil industry.
No, he prevented other people from engaging in a contract with those particular transporters. But there's nothing that he did to preclude them from entering into a contract with other transporters.
But there were no other transporters. The railroads were a natural monopoly.
Well, then that is not Rockefeller's fault. And on this point, you're right. This is the evil of government intervening in the economy, where it set up exclusive franchises for railroads, such as those in California with the Big Four. And they did.
But the railroads in New York were not ruled by the government. And then when this guy, Mr. Harlan Dow, when he tries to ship his oil by his horse-drawn cart, mm-hmm. then what Standard Oil does is they come in and they sell below their own cost.
Which benefits Standard Oil and also benefits customers. What's wrong with that?
Well, it puts all the competitors out of business. See, what you're talking about...
That's in the nature of the free competition system that we have.
Okay,
some people win, some people lose.
If we extend your logic, then what we end up with are a small number of very large corporations who essentially own entire marketplace, huge swaths of marketplaces, and small entrepreneurial businesses like have built America are out. They're out of luck.
Well, how did they build America then if the logic of what you're saying actually happened?
Well, because up until Ronald Reagan came along, we enforced antitrust laws in the United States.
And
you think that we should continue not enforcing them?
That's actually not the case. These big trusts you're talking about started as small entrepreneurs, and they all proliferated and grew way before the antitrust laws were passed and were enforced.
And every cancer starts as a single cell.
Well, that's a fascinating analogy. It's got no application to antitrust.
I think it's a very significant analogy because in biological systems, you have balance. You have organs, you have a liver, you have kidneys, you have lungs, you have a bunch of different things in your body that are actually cooperating. They're actually operating in balance, and there's a regulatory system that keeps each one in its own sphere of influence, shall we say, so that it doesn't take over others. But if a couple of cells in your small intestine or your large intestine decide that they're just going to grow like crazy, they're going to start taking nutrients from everybody else, and they start sending out tendrils and pulling nutrients from your liver and pulling nutrients, you've got cancer. And that's what we're talking about here. What you're describing, what you're advocating is cancer, economic cancer.
Well, again, it's a little overused, but at least it's an interesting, semi-interesting metaphor, but it's got no application.
Well, please refute
First of all, you're going on the premise that, which you've now implied a couple of times, that there is some, like, fixed amount of wealth in the universe, or like we all live in this Garden of Eden. And these businesses...
I'm not suggesting either.
Such as Bill Gates or Rockefeller come along and they just snatch oil or they snatch software off the trees, and by doing this they somehow consume too much of the economic pie and don't leave anything for anybody else. The fact is that all of these products that you're talking about, you know, from pharmaceuticals to oil to software, these things are created by the prime movers in their field, such as...
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Well, then it's
Gary
their
Hall,
property.
What I'm suggesting is
Mr.
that...
Hyman, it's their property by right. Nobody else has a right to their property, to their patents or anything.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. What I'm saying is...
But by endorsing antitrust, you do disagree with that.
Well, no, you have to let me finish a sentence if you want to know what I'm saying. At a certain point... In terms of growth, when a company starts behaving in a way that monopolizes a market and prevents competition, that is the point at which capitalism becomes cancerous capitalism. That is the point at which what you hold up as the ideal, capitalism, as if it were a system of governance, which actually it's just an economic system, really needs to be controlled by a system of governance, we the people, democracy.
So at some point...
Tiger
Woods wins too many championships, as Barry Bonds does too?
If Tiger Woods and a half a dozen other people in the golf business got together and they said, we're going to form a trust and we're going to prevent anybody else from playing golf, it's just going to be us from now on, competent or not, because I don't think that you can successfully argue that all of these big companies are simply holding their place in the market because they are the best. Because you and I both know that in many cases their products are not the best. Microsoft's probably the best example of that.
So why do the customers continue to buy those products?
Because that you walk into a computer store and try and buy an operating system from somebody other than Microsoft.
Linux has 20% of the market right now.
Right, and it's...
You know what, Mr. Hartman, they said the exact same thing about every single major company ever since 1880. They said exactly the same thing about IBM. Oh, nobody's ever going to be able to compete with IBM, blah, blah, blah. And the fact is there are billions of dollars of venture capital out in the market just searching for the next young Bill Gates to finance him and bring down Microsoft.
Sure.
And capitalism has been leave markets free and capital and intelligent people will move into the market. That's how you protect, quote, the little guy.
No, you protect the little guy by saying there are limits on how far a big guy can go to controlling the market,
Why should there be a limit?
Because in this country, we want to encourage small businesses. We want to encourage small entrepreneurs. You and I both know that there is just an incredible number of people who start out with really great ideas, really brilliant ideas for little audio product. You know, let's talk about software. Microsoft, for example, spreadsheet software, word processing software, whatever. That's not even probably the best example because they spin those off as separate products. But things that got incorporated into their operating system that originally other people brought to market, other ideas that other people brought to market, and they said, oh, that's cool. People want that. We'll just eat their lunch. We'll offer it for free.
Yeah, or we'll buy them out and make them all fabulously wealthy, which they did.
Not always.
Well, but sometimes they did.
Well, monopolies are fine if you buy people out. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, first of all, you're completely misusing the term monopoly. The term monopoly doesn't apply in a free market situation.
So what is a monopoly?
The only proper use of the term monopoly is a coercive monopoly, which is a grant from the U.S. government. But I want to ask you a different question.
So in your mind, the only monopolies are those that are associated with government.
Yeah, the only way to exclude somebody from entering a market is by the government using its police power, by initiating physical force. Otherwise, on a free market, it's the best talent and the most money wins, as the history of capitalism has proven. But
when is the most money a good... the best talent... Okay, I'll give you that. The most money, is that... I mean, have we gotten that Darwinian that we say, hey, the rich rule because they're rich?
I completely lost what you're talking about. It's the capital in conjunction with some intelligent inventor or engineer. So why is that bad?
But you said
championing the rights of the little guy. Well, now you have these venture capital guys supporting the little guy. Why is that bad?
So you're suggesting that the rich, that if people are incredibly wealthy in the United States.
The financiers, let's say.
The financiers, let's say. Yes, that they have some right to own the market because they have the cash.
Absolutely. It's their money. Why shouldn't they have the right to own whatever they've supported? Just like the guys who put up the money for Google, why don't they have the right to own a significant portion of the company?
Yeah, well,
I mean, the same way that you own your house.
In the abstract, it's a fine question, but what happens when they get so much money and the vast majority of the rest of us are locked out? We go back to a Dickensian world where you've got a small number of very powerful financiers.
Like the radio market? Like you're locked out from the radio market?
Actually,
if you're good, some venture capital financiers.
Where you end up with a small number of very powerful financiers, a small number of very powerful wealthy people, and a large class of poor, terrified workers, and the middle class goes away. The world that you're describing doesn't provide for a middle class.
Poor, terrified workers. I mean, this sounds like language that...
Have you read A Christmas Carol? Do you know the history of Victorian England? Do you know?
The poor, terrified workers, this sounds like language that you only hear in the political science departments of American universities. And this is like a remnant of socialism and of Marxism.
You don't think that the 45 million uninsured Americans are terrified of getting sick?
I didn't know we were going to talk about...
You don't think the people who are working for $7 or $8 an hour.
Yeah.
You don't think the people who are working for $7 or $8 an hour are terrified of losing their job because they're literally one paycheck away from starvation.
I think what they're terrified of is getting sick in Canada or in.
So then we have poor terrified workers here.
No, I think they're afraid of getting sick in Canada or Great Britain because I have to wait a year just to get a CAT scan.
Oh, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. But
are we done?
No, we can continue after the break if you'd like.
It's your show.
Okay, yeah, let's do that.
You have a monopoly over your show.
Absolutely. And but I'm sharing it with you here.
Okay.
We're talking with Gary Hall, Ayn Rand, AynRand.org. We'll take your calls for Gary right after this break.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. I could break away.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our guest, Gary Hall with the Ayn Rand Institute, Ayn Rand, AynRand.org, the website. And Gary apparently believes that it's just fine that every city in America looks just identical to every other city in America because the natural monopolies have kind of wiped out all of the small businesses, right?
That's not exactly what I said.
Because they're better and they have more money.
I think the best should win in every field. That's right.
Okay, well... Well said. Hall, for your side. Hall in Monterey,
yeah.
California on the line. Hey, Hall, what's
up?
Hey,
thanks, Tom. It's actually Hal.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hal.
Close. Yeah, that's your guest is a fascinating person. I wonder if he's getting any funding from the conservatives, because the kind of garbage that's spewing from his mouth is just what they love to hear, that we have to debate this kind of ludicrous notions. But if you really believe that the best should rise in every field, then I would assume, sir, that you would certainly support antitrust laws. But I'm going to move off that a little bit. What do you feel about child labor laws? Do you think we should enforce those? Because after all, companies, they have their own businesses. They own the means of production. Why shouldn't they just employ kids? You have any problem with child labor laws, sir?
That's a question solely for the parents of the children.
Oh, so if the child...
So children
who have parents who don't love their kids very much and are willing to put them in factories, that's perfectly okay with you. Is that right, sir? Yes or no? Can you answer the question, please?
Have you ever read Plato?
Yeah. The answer, Hal, is a totalitarian state. Yeah, Hal, the answer is what Gary is saying is yes, that's fine. And the reason that I'm not screaming at you, Gary, I think it's important that people learn how to have these conversations in a reasonable way, because many of our listeners are going to have the same conversation with their brother-in-law, with somebody that they work with, and people have to learn how to have these conversations and still have their relationship intact, as it were, still recognize that we're all human beings here, even if you're wrong and I'm right, Gary. Gregory in Virginia on the line. Hey, Gregory.
Hey, call me John Galt.
Okay, there you go. What's
joke.
Up? Yeah, I know. It's a good objectivist joke.
I think the problem with Mr. Webb is not that he's an idiot, as I originally planned on calling him, that he's quite lucid and is just a master of the twisted word.
Okay, Gary Hall. Gary, I'm sorry, Greg. Greg in Virginia there, we're out of time. Gary, how did you give you the last response to that?
I
Tom, I'm at a loss. I have no idea who he was talking about or what who he was talking to or what
okay.
he was talking about.
All right. Well, Gary, I want to thank you for being with us today and for being willing to mix it up with me in here.
Oh,
a lot
pleasure.
Of folks are unwilling to, and I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. IonRand.org, the website, if you want to get more of the Objectivist philosophy and more information on, capitalism ruling the world, as it were. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, a lot on our table today. We have our interview with George Galloway. We'll be replaying bits and pieces of that. Might as well replay the entire thing in the third hour of our program. Get back to that. And we'll chop it up and make it a little more... digestible, give you an opportunity to comment on it, because he really does talk. We get into several different topic areas that I think are important. And, of course, in the last half hour of the last hour, we had a guest from the Ayn Rand Institute, which I have to say, to their credit, the last right-wing organization, although they wouldn't describe themselves as right-wing, but the last, whatever you want to call it, conservative organization that is willing to send people on this program. All the rest of them are, the Heritage Foundation, they won't send people to us anymore. They're just scared to come on the air with us. And it's a shame. And so try and treat them with some respect and hopefully we can get some more on, because I really appreciate those kinds of conversations. Because unfortunately, those are the conversations that we need to be having and we're not having in America. That people spout off right-wing talking points or conservative talking points or even objectivist talking points, and people don't know how to respond to them. They don't know the answer to that. Well, gee, that makes sense. It makes sense. If government is doing it with the force of guns, it must be coercion. But then you ask the question, well, who's government? It's a them, isn't it? No, it's us. Government is us. So if a small community, us, gets together and says, we'd really rather not be robbed, raped, and pillaged by a big box company store coming in here, or by, a monopoly saying that they're the only people who can sell oil, because they're going to go into collusion with the railroads and say, yeah, you can't do it. Then we, the people, get to say, sorry, guys, if you're going to do business in our society, you're going to do it in a way that actually produces some benefit to us. Otherwise, you're just a cancer in the body politic. Anyway, let's take a few calls on this. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Richard in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Ah, thank you. Hey, I just want to comment on the free market system. In 1948, the Tucker automobile came out, and I got to see one in San Francisco. It had seat belts. It had cushions inside the car. It had a... just fabulous car.
Yeah, it was marketed both as a high-end car and as a safe car.
Exactly.
Because so many people in the 40s were dying in car accidents.
Right, and it was just a beautiful car, and the three car manufacturers just it was no competition.
They took them out.
They just, and it was the best car, one of the best cars ever made in America.
Yeah.
Another factor would be the Aero... supersonic jet. I don't know if you're familiar with that from Canada. In 1958, they made that, and that didn't go to the top. We didn't invest in it because Lockheed and Martin just shot it down.
Now, what our guest would say is, so what? That's the market. That's, business, big business eating little business. Tough. Yeah. They've got the most money and the best brains. They have every right to it. My response to that, by the way, would be, but, if there is something that may benefit we the people, if it's going to work to our advantage, maybe we should collectively participate in subsidizing it or helping it out or, nurturing some of these industries.
Yeah, but he says the best things, superior products, always go to the top, which is not true.
No, it's patently not true. It's a nice mythology. It's a utopian vision, really. I mean, the objectivists, and keep in mind, Alan Greenspan, you know, was initiated into this in Ayn Rand's apartment in the 1950s. The objectivists are utopianists, just like the Bolsheviks were, just like the early communists were, the Marxists. They're idealists. They believe, if only everybody thought this way, if only the world worked this way, we'd live in a paradise. And you know, it's as Barry Goldwater said, you know, I want to warn you that those who are seeking absolute power for a vision of good are the ones who do the greatest harm to America or to the nation. And I'm not to say that these guys are doing harm to the country, but the potential is tremendous.
It's there.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Kevin in Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Kevin.
Tom, how you doing? I wanted to just to say first that I appreciate you having civil discourse with people whose opinions disagree with yours, which leads me into that I have to call you on the carpet a little bit. I noticed a little bit of hypocrisy today when you were reading that statement about the trusts. You were saying that
I was actually quoting from my own book. That's from Unequal Protection.
Okay, you were getting in a little plug there, but you were quoting, saying that let's eliminate this nasty business of competition. We'll all band together, and we'll eliminate the competition. Is that correct?
Those words were actually in the charters in the 1880s. In the charters of the sugar trust, the copper trust, the tin trust, the paper bag trust, the match trust, and pretty clearly in Standard Oil Trust.
And basically, what you're saying is you're locking out other people from working or having companies because these companies are so big. And I agree with you. I agree that monopolies are wrong because they do, in fact, lock other companies out by, like Microsoft did and things along those lines. However, the hypocrisy I have or that I've noticed with you is you're pro-union. What is a union except for let's band together, we'll make our own rules, we'll band together, we'll lock out competition, meaning, you know, I live in Philadelphia. You can't build a building in Philadelphia unless it's union labor. If you build it with non-union labor, they'll burn it down or they'll protest you and intimidate you to get out of town. So,
Kevin, first of all, if any union burns down a building, They're toast. You know, you put them out of business. That's a crime. You're mixing apples and oranges here.
Utopianism.
I'm not.
You don't live in Philadelphia or New York.
No, Kevin. Kevin, I've done business in both cities, and certainly have dealt with.
Have you built a building in Philadelphia?
Kevin, let me make my point here.
Okay, I will.
Yeah, thank you. The unions, first of all, yes, there have been abuses in the past, just as, in fact, I would say even far more, there have been abuses on the other side of companies, Pinkerton came into business for the purpose of threatening and intimidating workers. What unions are about is not monopolies. What unions are about is democracy in the workplace. What a union is about is is allowing workers to have some say in how the workplace works. When unions operate in such a way that it becomes anti-competitive or becomes monopolistic, when they operate in such a way that an industry becomes anti-competitive or monopolistic, they're regulated. There are rules against that.
What about the thousands of unions? I have a lot of union friends around here, always out of work because they can't find work because, you know, the high wages, they're extraordinarily above market wages. They can't employ everybody. They employ half.
Yeah, and the problem there is not the fact that you have unions. No, you're employing the Rush Limbaugh logic here, Kevin, this is the danger of it. I mean, this is where you're going with this thing. Oh, the fault is the union. I'm sorry, the fault is domestic policies. It's trade policies and labor policies in the United States. The reality is that every time that the minimum wage gets raised, Kevin, employment actually goes up. Unemployment doesn't go up, employment goes up. Inflation goes down every time the minimum wage is raised. What unions do is they set the floor for wages.
What I'm saying, Tom, is say I'm building a building, real simply for your audience. I'm talking, I'm not trying to dumb it down for you. I know you understand this. If I have $2 million and I'm an investor, I can either build one building or two buildings. If I have to pay a carpenter $40 an hour, I can build one building and employ 10 carpenters. If I have to pay a carpenter $20 an hour, I can build two buildings and employ 20 carpenters. What's better?
Well,
so
the question, okay, let's take that example, Kevin. Now, the question, the larger question that you're completely missing here is, do we want to have a middle class in the community where you're building that building?
You're not a middle class if you're making $20 an hour?
Well, you said $10 or $20, didn't you?
$20 or $40. That's not the point.
Well, see, I think 10 or 20 is actually a fairly good example of it, because what you have right now in the United States is you have all over the country, particularly in the so-called right-to-work states, is you have a situation where illegal immigrants are coming in, and they're filling these jobs at $5 to $10 an hour, and as a result, you know, you've got, as you said, unemployed union folks. And, the reason why illegal immigrants are flocking into the United States now, and they weren't 30 years ago, isn't that all of a sudden we threw our borders open, because they've always been open. It's that the wages have been dropping to the point where, you know, hey, it's pretty conspicuous. You can get a job at this kind of wage. And it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that we said we're going to pay good, solid, middle-class wages. Everybody had a chance to work.
Tom, you're not addressing the fact that if you're against the trust, which I am, you should be against union setting the price for labor too. It's one and the same. It's hand in glove at that point.
Well, unions don't set the price for labor. You're thinking that a union comes in and says this is the price. Unions negotiate the price for labor, Kevin, and they have to negotiate it in the marketplace. If unions set the price for labor. No, if unions, come on, Kevin. If unions set the price for labor, everybody in the United States would be making $70,000 a year. Works for a union. Give me a break.
Let me just give you the example. I work in Philadelphia County and also work in Lancaster County, which is kind of real close to each other. Guys that build a house. You can build a house. A carpenter in Lancaster gets paid, just say, $50,000 a year. I'm making that number up. Carpenter in Philadelphia gets paid $75,000 a year. Why is that? They set the price of labor. It's, you know, two abutting townships or two abutting counties.
If a group of people are getting to, here's where I suppose our Ayn Rand guy would probably agree with this. If a bunch of people get together and say, this is the price for which we will work. This is the price for which we'll work. And they negotiate with their employer, and the employer says, okay, I will agree to you that that's the price I'm going to pay you, which is called negotiating a contract. What's wrong with that, Kevin?
With a gun to your head. You'll either give us this price, or we will walk out.
Well, the flip side of it is the employer has a gun to labor's head saying, hey, you know, I'll just go someplace else and build the building. There is an equal gun on both sides. That's why the whole point of unions is about balancing power, Kevin. Kevin, I got to move along. I appreciate the conversation. It's good. You give as good as you get. I do appreciate that. Let's see here. Cheryl in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Cheryl, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment while you're on the topic of predatory economic system that Mr.
Right.
Hall was advocating. I mean, you just wonder what kind of conscience he has. And, you know, we have, in this particular area, we haven't been able to prove it yet, but we have collusion in the gas world. We have the highest prices of anywhere in the state.
Well, you want proof of it? Look at yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Right on the front page was a graph showing the profits made from refining a barrel of oil. And it's gone from under a dollar 3 years ago to over $4 now. And that's the profit that they're making. It has nothing to do with supply or demand. It has to do with them saying, hey, we own the market. We'll charge whatever we want. We can use the increase in crude oil as an excuse to jack up the price of gasoline and make huge profits.
Right. And not only does it make other businesses uncompetitive, because that increase in transportation costs, and it makes us as a nation, it hurts the little people, and it just trickles on down. And so this predatory economic policy, you know, it needs to be stopped. I mean, yeah. I appreciate your point of view in pointing out what you've done.
Yeah, thank you very much, Cheryl. I appreciate it. See, at a certain point, business is a good thing in general. I mean, I'm all in favor of business and starting business and small and medium-sized business. But there's a certain point, just like, you know, cells growing in a body, it's a good thing. But there's a certain point when the growth becomes out of control. Come on in, Dave. When it becomes out of control, that you got to say, hey, wait a minute, this is cancer. We have to regulate this.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'd like to take you to the ceremony.
Yes, good old Leonard Cohen. Welcome back, my friends.
Remember the way.
Remembering the way back to democracy. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Oregon on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
I love that line. Did I hear you correctly? Did Norm Coleman take down Galloway's Senate record testimony?
Yes, and Mr. Galloway had some thoughts on that topic. In fact, I think I know where it is. Let's just see if this is it.
What I managed to do, and I thank God for the breath that he gave me to do it, was blow away the smokescreen that these people are trying to throw up to divert attention from the very real crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors that they themselves are responsible for. And I've had, and I'm not exaggerating this, more than 12,000 emails from the United States. 12,000 emails. And it's not easy in the United States to find out the email address of a British parliamentarian.
Yeah.
And these people have all written to me. Many of them have drawn attention to the fact that although for one day, just 24 hours, my testimony was on the website, it has now been wiped off it. And that tells you all you need to know, really, about the quality of the commitment to democracy and open government that these people really have, as opposed to the talk that they talk.
Yeah, well said.
No, that's an appalling thing. I think it's ironic that we have a Brit trying to help us save our democracy.
Yeah, yeah, it is ironic, and we'll take all the help we can get.
Yeah, and just, you know, about the Ayn Rand thing, if you were an Ayn Rand group, you know, how would you define the commons? It seems to me so much of this conversation has to do with
that's the problem.
Actually, the commons.
Ayn Rand never understood the commons, and I would suggest that by and large, the only commons that are recognized by the objectivists is the military and police departments.
Yeah, I got into the conversation with a friend of mine the other day who identified that as his economic philosophy, and we fairly quickly came to that same conclusion. And my observation is that Ayn Rand is coming out of Russia absolutely has no idea, as
right.
intelligent as well she may be. You know, I was raised Catholic. I was not raised Methodist. I don't know what it's like to be Methodist, and I don't believe that Ayn Rand had any idea of what capitalism is truly capable of.
Yeah, interestingly, I was raised Methodist. I don't have any idea what it's like to be Catholic. But,
well,
but
I don't have any horns on my head.
Yeah,
so.
Well, that's good to know, Mike. But you know, the point is that Ayn Rand, and a lot of people don't realize this, Ayn Rand was a child in Bolshevik Russia. When the Russian Revolution happened, she was 8 or 9 years old. Her father owned, as I recall, a pharmacy shop or some sort of retail store. And it was taken over by the Bolsheviks. He lost everything. I mean, he was not a wealthy guy, but he was sort of the mercantile middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was broken by that, as were many people. I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution was pretty tough. And although, you know, what the excesses of the Tsar and Tsarina were pretty tough, too. I mean, we don't need to refight the Russian Revolution here. But in any case, she ended up going to university in Kiev. Actually, where my oldest daughter studied, actually, and only she was my daughter was there after the fall of the Soviet Union. Ayn Rand was there when it was the Soviet Union, and she studied political science and got a degree in it. And what she studied was that communism good, capitalism bad. I mean, that was, you know, it was this dichotomy, there was this black and white world, and they conflated an economic system with a political system. They thought that capitalism was a political system. It's not. It's an economic system. And they suggested that communism was an economic system and a political system. And, you know, it's not. You know, communism, or maybe it is. I don't know. But in any case, you could argue it. But she got confused. She got mixed up. And the result of that is this strange notion that a lot of the objectivists have, that capitalism has something to do with good government, and it doesn't. In fact, there's a dynamic tension there, just like there, and it's a good tension, just like you should have tension between Democrats and Republicans.
Well, right.
There should be tension between democracy and capitalism, but you can't just have it all one way. Mike, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Great
Bye.
To hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Coming up, Joanne Davis is going to be talking to us about, for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, the little secret that can change your life. First, Rick in Grand Rapids calling presumably on the topics of one of the two previous hours here. Hey, Rick.
Yes, it was an interesting show. I didn't hear all of it. I heard part of your interview with Mr. Galloway, was it?
Yeah, I'm going to replay it in the next hour, too.
We don't get that here in this town. But anyway, I did see him on television as well when he was in front of Mr. Coleman's committee, I guess it was, or subcommittee, and I think he did a great job. And with Coleman, it was just proceed to act like the
prosecutor. You can see why Coleman has removed it from his website, from the Senate website.
The guy is, I don't know, he doesn't have much seniority in the Republican Party. He's the guy that defeated Mondale, right?
I don't recall.
When Mondale had to fill in for Mr. Wellstone.
Yeah, I believe so, but
yeah,
I could be
yeah.
wrong.
And he's a former Democrat. I guess he's a former mayor of Minneapolis. But he kind of reminds me of the kid who in school, you know, who always raised his hand whenever the teacher asked a question because he knew the answer. He's just so willing to prove he's a loyal. But I also heard your comment now about the Ayn Rand folks. That's the only conservative group that'll send people. Have you tried to get anybody from the Birch Society to come on?
You know, I'm not sure if we have. That's a good suggestion. I'll follow up on it.
Because you and I have talked about that, and I think we came to an agreement that for conservatives, they're actually pretty honest people. They've done cover stories of their...
Oh, yeah, the Birch Society, like the Ayn Rand folks. You know, if you want a right-winger who's actually going to tell you what they think rather than a right-winger who's going to try and weasel out of it, they'll do it. Rick, thanks for the call. I'll check that out. Mike in Washington, D.C. What's up, Mike?
Hey, Tom. Well, like I said, Coleman got rid of Galloway's testimony.
Yeah, and
off the site.
Yeah.
And how dare you hold a gun to the head of big business?
Me?
And demand that workers be paid something close to a living wage.
Me?
I don't understand these people.
Well, see, this is the thing. Folks have been listening to right-wing talk radio so long that they have obviously forgotten labor history, that some folks, I think, you know, in good conscience and in reality, don't get it, that unionization is about balancing power in the workplace so that people in the workplace can have a, you know, reasonable opportunity to talk on a level playing field with the people who own the company, and they just don't get it. I got to move along, Mike. Frank in Phoenix. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great. What's up?
How come those workers, you know, they complain about their low wages and all of this while they're complaining about unions giving, you know, are able to negotiate the corporations for those benefits or higher wages? You know, you have workers complaining about having their low pay. Wouldn't you think that if the unions were around more, that immigration would be controlled because you can't join a union unless you have those skills for that job?
Well, yeah, and in fact, if you look back, you know, 30 years ago, before Ronald Reagan came in and declared war on working people in the United States, and certainly declared war on organized labor in 1981, 30 years ago, you didn't have a problem with massive illegal immigration in the United States. I mean, right now we have roughly 10% of the population of Mexico working in the United States, generating somewhere between 10 and 20% of the total gross domestic product of Mexico by sending money home. And, you know, and at the time that Reagan came into office, it certainly was not the case. A quarter of America's workforce was unionized. 50% of all Americans could raise a family with a single paycheck. Today, it's down to 8%. So you've got, you know, 16% of Americans, roughly, because every union job generally produces one equivalent job. 16% of Americans can raise a family with a single paycheck, pay for education, pay, you know, have decent health care, and have a retirement. And the result of that is, as the floor has fallen down to the point where it just seems, hey, you know, we can get the regular folks in for, you know, or citizens in, let's say, because this is not about race and this is not about national origin. This is really about national boundaries. We can get citizens in for $10 an hour, or we can get illegals in for $8 an hour. You know, what the heck? Let's go with the illegals. As the floor has dropped, it's become easier to rationalize that. Frank, I got to move along. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Tim in Illinois, last call here. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I
have a question for you. It's a little long, so bear with me. I think of the objectivists, the neocons, the fascists, and the extreme right wing as psychopaths. Can you talk a bit about psychopathic personalities and maybe identify what are the likely events in their childhoods that would later in life lead to this adult behavior that's characterized by disregard for the rights and needs of others, antisocial acts with no remorse, compulsive lying, compulsive stealing, unwillingness to take responsibility for their actions, and the big one, lack of conscience.
Yeah, what you're describing is not a psychopath, but a sociopath. But I get your point. And I don't think, frankly, that that our guest is a sociopath. I think, you know, these are people who are just true believers. They're utopianists. And we all are in our own little ways and, you know, one way or another, you know, true believers in something. I mean, we all have things that we believe in that...
But isn't there a fork in the road somewhere in your formative years where that will result in you having a mindset where you just don't care about others, where you don't have that feeling?
Yeah, the origin of sociopathy, the origin of the lack of empathy, yeah, you know, appears to have to do with, you know, inappropriate bonding with parents or the lack of bonding with parents. The
attacking a country and killing
these are called attachment disorders.
Attacking a country and killing 100,000 people, taking away the funding for...
Well, you know, George W. Bush, when he was a kid, used to put firecrackers in frogs and blow them up and kill them. And that's the behavior that you see in sociopaths. And George W. was, you know, did make fun of the people that he killed when he was governor of Texas. And there are some people who I think, you know, without hysteria and without, you know, screaming and pointing fingers and calling names, say, hey, this guy may have some sort of a personality disorder. I'm not here to diagnose George Bush, and I don't want to do that, or I don't want to get into that. But the point is, yeah, sure. And some of them are like that. And I think that the larger question is, you know, at what point, well, there's another dimension to this, too, just real quickly, Tim. And that is that some folks are raised in very authoritarian households, and they believe that the way to control everything is by imposing authority on it. And obviously that's the mantra of the Bush administration, to a large extent the Republican Party these days. George Lakoff talks about the harsh father model versus the nurturing family model, and that the Republicans to some extent have embraced the harsh father and the Democrats the nurturing family. It's a really sloppy overgeneralization, and the reality is that probably only a small percentage of the Republicans are harsh father oriented, and some Democrats are, but there's some reality to it, and it probably has to do with parenting. Anyhow, Joanne Davis is with us. Joanne is the author of a cool little book called The Little Secret That Can Change Your Life. If you win the rat race, you're still a rat, Joanne says. Hey, Joanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased you're here. Who is suffering from affluenza, and what are its symptoms?
Lots of people in America are suffering from affluenza, which I think has been described, not by me, but by others, as the prosperity disease. And the prosperity disease is one in which you're convinced that enough is never enough, that you have to stay on the treadmill of buying and spending, that bigger is better and faster is better. And I think that in the 80s and the 90s, when America was on this boom, lots of people caught the affluenza illness.
Yeah, a mental virus, as it were, a meme, a thought virus. This was the greed is good era.
Yeah, the greed is good era. We got whole television stations that keep us apprised of what's going on. You have to watch a stock ticker tape going across the bottom of your television set. You have to have an entire financial channel because that's the heartbeat and the pulse of America, what's going on in the stock market, not what's happening in your own family or your own emotional life, but the financial health of the country is really preeminent.
And how do you think we got here?
I think we got here because we're in an age of marketing and advertising where our minds are really conditioned to believe that we have to have what we see. There are a lot of subliminal and not so subliminal messages coming at us. We think that the mall is a destination. We think that shopping is a sport. We put children in strollers and we circle them around and around where at eye level all they can see are the things that want. We've raised an entire generation, and I would say that I, you know, made my share of mistakes, that their favorite words are, can you have, will you get me, can I get? We think that the world, particularly in America, the American dream is about acquiring, and we've forgotten that there's another part of the equation, which is sacrificing, giving back, and building community.
But why should I sacrifice, give back, and build community when I can get stuff?
Well, you may not want to, but I think that the world...
Actually, I would like to, but...
Well, good for you. I'm not here to really preach to others about what they should do. I think that... Like,
oh, feel free, Joanne.
Well, I think that, like all writers, I write what I need to learn myself.
Sure.
So I've set out, you know, to try to observe what it is about my own life that I would like to correct, and I guess my ideas are just out there for others to bounce off of. But I think that the world is a troubled place. We can look around. We have massive poverty in this country, side by side with the affluenza. Is that okay? Is it okay for there to be such a great divide between the haves and the have-nots? In the current political environment, one might think it is.
Well, in fact, there are folks out there who are aggressively saying that it's okay. Not only is it okay, but you've got an entire administration dedicated to giving more and more tax cuts and whatnot to the wealthy and taking more and more from working people.
Amen to that.
Do you think that they're all suffering from affluenza? I mean, how much is enough? Dick Cheney walks away from Halliburton with $30-40 million as a severance package, and he still has what may be as much as $100 million in stock options, which is probably worth around $20 or $30 million when he first became vice president. But because of Halliburton's contracts with Iraq, may now be worth $100 million. Plus, he's making as much from Halliburton while he's vice president as he is as vice president, and people just don't think that there's anything weird about that. Why?
Well, I think that it's because we have, in America, have accepted the notion of the me generation instead of looking for another model, which might be called the we generation, that we're in this together. And America is the land of opportunity. People come here to make it big. And I think that in some respects, it's interesting we're having the Social Security debate, people have actually lost faith in the notion that there is a social net under us. Wasn't it Ronald Reagan who cut it out from under us? Every person is supposed to make it on their own. And that's actually a very dangerous idea because it's unleashing the individual to fend for themselves when, in fact, you'll never come to a point where you'll really accept that enough is enough. Enough is never enough what you're after.
And in fact, we are social animals.
I think we are social animals, but I think that people have to remember that there's a common good, and the common good has to exist side by side with the individual good. And if they don't, then everybody is really going to continue on never really feeling that their appetite is satisfied. The French have a great saying, I write about it, with the eating comes the appetite. The more you eat, the more you want. What is it that's made people obese? What is it that makes people feel like their cravings can never be satisfied? The appetite is expanding with the eating. And that's a function of missing out on what I would call certain spiritual qualities that make people feel fulfilled as individuals. We're all concerned with making a living. We're not necessarily making a life. A life has many other intangible qualities that have to do with connecting with other people, having relationships, and realizing that caring and kindness and doing it because it's a good thing is as important as doing it because there's something in it for you. We've all bought into the reward mentality, which makes us try to see what's at the end of the game rather than enjoying it as we go along and connecting with people, because that's just wholesome and rewarding in and of itself.
Yeah. You say that if every person who reads your book, The Little Secret That Can Change Your Life, Joanne Davis, you say that if every person who reads this book chooses just one way to leave the rat race, the world would become a better place. I just threw away my cell phone. Mm-hmm. Does that qualify?
If it helps you, I don't think that anybody can tell you in particular what's better. I really believe people have an intuition that's gotten buried in the busyness of life.
Uh-huh.
I think that if you stopped tuning out to what's on television and maybe even what's on radio, although we're on radio, and listen to what your inner voice is telling you about what's wrong, you're going to be way better off than if you listen to the quote-unquote pundits, because I think that those people are more or less wrong about what's going on in your life. So you should be quiet and go inside and listen to what your inner voice is telling you, because I assure you that the culture is drowning it out.
Is that the secret that could change our lives?
No, I think the secret that can change your life is to look at our culture and identify that it is a rat race, that we are all running to stand still, and we're like gerbils in the cage getting nowhere. And I think we should stop defining progress solely in dollar and cents terms and remember that in addition to this big stock market economy, there's a spiritual economy in which we exchange virtues and values that are really humane and meaningful. And those would include love, caring, and kindness, and forgiving people. You know, you were talking earlier about these right-wing shows where people just yell at each other. And I think that that's all heat and no light. People have to get real, and people have to listen and speak the truth in love to one another and love the truth in each. And if you're doing that, you're going to be way ahead of the game.
How do you respond, Joanne, just real quickly? We have just a little less than a minute left. How do you respond to folks who say, oh, that sounds nice, but it sounds kind of like New Age woo-woo stuff, and you know, people are really not that way. People really like to just crush each other.
Yeah, I mean, they may be like people who like to crush each other. They're aggressive, warrior people, but I have an optimistic vision that good things are contagious. And I think if other people want to be that way, then we shall let them be. I shall certainly let them be. If they don't want to listen, if you want to put wax in your ears, that's just fine by me. I'm not out to convert anyone. I think if you make a good example of yourself, others will see. Don't hide your light under a bushel. Let it shine. And that's good enough for me.
Yeah, it sounds like you're advocating the original message of Christianity. Change yourself, and maybe the world around you will change. Maybe not, but at least you will have changed yourself.
Yeah, and I think as Tolstoy said, everyone wants to change the world. No one wants to change themselves. So don't worry about the global picture. Worry about what's happening in your home, in your family, and most importantly, in your heart.
Yeah, and I should say not just Christianity, Judaism, Islam, all the world's religions, basically. I mean, this is the core message. Joanne Davis, the author of The Little Secret That Can Change Your Life. If you win the rat race, you're still a rat. Thanks, Joanne, for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The fact is that they tell you lies for name, like oil becomes democracy. The fact is that they tell you lies that then get different names, like collateral damage.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com, excuse me, our website, if you want to drop in and say hi, click live chat. You can drop into our live chat room. Today, the first day in probably 2 years that I haven't been in the chat room while I'm doing the program. The reason why, because on this particular computer in this studio, the software with which I can play George Galloway and the software that runs our chat room won't coexist on the same page. So, you know, I had a choice, be in the chat room or be able to play George Galloway clips, and I chose to go with the George Galloway clips, unfortunately. But I say hi to all the folks in our chat room, and I will be back tomorrow by all means. Let's just hear a few thoughts from Mr. Galloway as we wrap up this hour.
The illegal process which is being followed. People are being taken, in some cases, from third countries. One of the British citizens, for example, was taken from the Gambia. Others have been taken from Pakistan. Others still from Afghanistan. They're taken by force, drugs forcibly injected into them, hooded, chained, and taken to a cage in the tropics where, by all accounts, they're being kept in conditions that you wouldn't keep a dog in your country or mine. And if you did, you'd be had up for cruelty by the authorities. And then there's very clear evidence of systematic torture. There's the desecration of the Quran, which may or may not have happened, depending on which edition of Newsweek you are prepared to believe. This is a big scar on the face of the United States. And it seems to me that too few citizens of the United States have fastened on to the fact that the protestations by your president and your government of being interested in human rights and democracy and freedom are quite negated by the very existence of Guantanamo Bay. But of course, that's not the end of it. Bagram Air Base is exactly the same kind of place. Abu Ghraib prison, well, we perhaps on a family show shouldn't probe too deeply into the disgusting obscenities that were going on there. And it turns out that where the United States itself is not prepared to physically torture people, it merely subcontracts out the task.
So, George Galloway, Member of Parliament, British House of Commons, the fellow who cleaned Norm Coleman's clock. One of our chat room folks mentions, by the way, the Senate actually does have the video of his testimony on their website, although the transcript, the words, have been scrubbed from the official record. So, I guess a little good, a little bad. I don't know. However you want to define it. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, our website, if you'd like to drop by, drop into the live chat room, leave a message on the message board. Within the next few hours, I will have on our website at TomHartman.com, the entire interview with George Galloway. Right now, you can listen to it on the 620KPOJ.com website, the website of the Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington radio station where I do a morning show before I do this program. And that's at 620KPOJ.com. You can listen to it right now and direct your friends to it if you wish. But here's the interview. This morning, we interviewed George Galloway, member of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, and asked his thoughts on a whole variety of things, actually. Privatization, George W. Bush, is Bush a war criminal, what should be done, what about Guantanamo Bay, what's its impact, and so on. So let's just I just want to share part of this with you. Thanks so much, Mr. Galloway, for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
First of all, my apologies if I have your title wrong. I'm calling you Mr. Is that how...
No, Mr. is more than adequate.
Okay. I'm wondering, what is your opinion on the legality of Guantanamo Bay, and what do you think about the construction of a death chamber there, which was reported by the BBC yesterday?
Well, it's an utterly illegal process which is being followed. People are being taken, in some cases, from third countries. One of the British citizens, for example, was taken from the Gambia. Others have been taken from Pakistan. Others still from Afghanistan. They're taken by force, drugs forcibly injected into them, hooded, chained, and taken to a cage in the tropics where, by all accounts, they're being kept in conditions that you wouldn't keep a dog in your country or mine. And if you did, you'd be had up for cruelty by the authorities. And then there's very clear evidence of systematic torture. There's the desecration of the Quran, which may or may not have happened, depending on which edition of Newsweek you are prepared to believe. This is a big scar on the face of the United States. And it seems to me that too few citizens of the United States have fastened on to the fact that the protestations by your president and your government of being interested in human rights and democracy and freedom are quite negated by the very existence of Guantanamo Bay. But of course, that's not the end of it. Bagram Air Base is exactly the same kind of place. Abu Ghraib prison, well, we perhaps on a family show shouldn't probe too deeply into the disgusting obscenities that were going on there. And it turns out that where the United States itself is not prepared to physically torture people, it merely subcontracts out the task. sending people to the likes of Uzbekistan and Egypt and other prison states where less squeamish governments will torture people for the United States and give the U.S. the testimony they get as a result, which, of course, it goes without saying, is almost never of any use because anyone will say anything under torture.
Yes.
And all sorts of wild goose chases are no doubt embarked upon as a result of all this. So I'm afraid Guantanamo is a blot on the landscape, and the fact that the United States occupies it in Cuba without Cuba's agreement is just the icing on the cake.
Yeah. George Galloway, a member of Parliament in Great Britain, of the House of Commons. Why do you believe that Tony Blair decided to join President Bush in waging war when, as has recently emerged with this Downing Street memo, he knew that the case was flimsy? And do you think that either Blair or Bush or people in their administration should be prosecuted on any level for this activity?
Well, first of all, I'm sure that they will not be prosecuted because it's only losers that are prosecuted. In the international system that we have, there's no chance of the likes of Henry Kissinger, for example, the greatest living war criminal in the world today, with the blood of millions of people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Chile and East Timor and many other places on his hands. He will never appear in a court or be behind bars. That's for the tin pot tyrants, the tiny tyrants like Milosevic. They get sent there. The big tyrants never face justice. I wish I knew the answer to your first question. Why did Tony Blair join it? Certainly it's been utterly ruinous to his political reputation. He will be followed into the history books and into the grave with this mark of Cain on his forehead. He will be remembered for nothing other than that he followed George W. Bush over a cliff, took the rest of us with them, and we haven't yet reached the bottom, I'm afraid. All I can say from my own conversations with Mr. Blair, man to man, are that I think that both him and George W. Bush are possessed of a kind of messianic belief that somebody, God perhaps, gave them the job of shouldering the white man's burden, which is the world, that someone gave them the right to step outside of international law, go anywhere, do anything, pay any price in other people's blood to reshape the world in their image, in the image that they want to see. And I think that both men will be damned in history. Both men have made their respective countries the two most hated countries in the world. They have endangered the lives and safety of our citizens. They have damaged our economic and cultural and social interests. And they should face prosecution, but never will.
Yeah. Mr. Galloway, you called for a police inquiry into ballot fraud and ghost voting in Bethnal Green and Bow. In America now, we just have this just recently released. Congressman John Conyers went to Ohio and held hearings, 13 or 12 members of Congress, several weeks of hearings under oath, and determined that there was considerable election fraud in this last election where George Bush became president. And, of course, we know now that, in fact, it was first reported on the BBC. Americans didn't know it, but folks in the UK knew within weeks of the 2000 election that George Bush's brother Jeb and Kathleen Harris in Florida had conspired to remove the names of tens of thousands of legally registered African Americans, largely Democratic voters, from the rolls there in Florida. What do you think is the solution to making elections, both in the United States and the United Kingdom, and around the world for that matter, open, fair, and accurate?
Well, you know, we're used to sending observers to third world countries and former banana republics to observe their elections. But the British election recently and your election just a little more distantly, and the one in 2000 for that matter, really, if they had been observed by third world observers, would have been declared bogus and deeply flawed. Your president stole the presidency in Florida using his brother and his brother's close friends to cheat the people of the United States out of their freely elected president, who was undoubtedly Al Gore, even if you only counted the votes that actually made it through the hoops in order to be cast. The president was really Al Gore. In Ohio, and I've read the stuff that Congressman Conyers is doing, and I commend it. It's clear enough on the face of it that there was substantial fraud in that state, and thus delivering the Electoral College vote for President Bush. In our country, the government have vastly inflated the number of people voting by post, which, as the courts have found, is wide open to electoral fraud, and electoral fraud there has been. I don't need to deal with the allegations, which are in their thousands. I can just deal with the cases that have already been dealt with. Six new Labour councillors were struck off and thrown out of the council in Birmingham, which is Britain's second city, having been caught red-handed in a room around a table at the dead of night, at midnight, with thousands, and I mean thousands, of other people's ballot papers that they were happily filling in. And they are now facing criminal prosecution as a result. Another new Labour councillor in the town of Blackburn, where the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw represents, and he was a close associate of Jack Straw, and he was a 65 or 67-year-old man, has just been sent to prison for 3.5 years for having been caught red-handed doing exactly the same thing. When you add the thousands of allegations that there now are of voter fraud in the last election, then I've called for the police to move in en masse, because we are heading down the road towards a kind of corruption that we never thought we'd see. Perhaps it's an innate sense of democratic superiority on our part. We used to think that that kind of ballot rigging and voter fraud was something that happened in other countries, not in the mother of democracies, Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was a vote-by-mail problems that you're having in the UK. Here in Oregon, we have the only vote-by-mail system in the state, and I think we've always thought that it was impregnable. It was immune.
Well, yours may be. Ours is very far from that. And when the electoral rolls are in the state that they're in my own constituency, for example, there were no less than 14 voters registered in one flat in Brick Lane, which is a heavily Asian Bengali area, Bangladeshi area in my constituency. And when we went there, not only were there not 14 voters living there, which would have been odd in any case given the size of the apartments, but there were no voters living there. Indeed, there was no one living there. It was utterly derelict. Now, somebody registered them and many hundreds, maybe even thousands of others, for votes that they would cast by post, who simply didn't exist. And of course, the scam is that someone picks up the ballot papers when they're posted out by the authority, fills them in, and returns them.
Yeah. George Galloway, a member of the of Parliament, a member of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom. What lessons have you learned, if I can change the topic just for a moment, to economics? And then if you have another moment, I'd like to get back to the loss of freedoms in the wake of 9/11. But I'm curious about privatization in the UK. It's all the rage in the United States. I was over there when you were privatizing your railroads. Could you speak to the citizens of America about the dangers of privatization, please?
Well, what a way to run a railroad. That's what most people in the country are saying now. And how's this for a turnaround? British Rail, which was owned by the state, which was a nationalized railway, was probably the least loved institution in the United Kingdom when Mrs. Thatcher privatized it. Now, fully 80% of the people of the country, 88.0% of the people of the country, want the railways taken back into public ownership, because they realize now that we're paying three times the subsidy to the private owners of the privatized railways that we were paying to the nationalized railways, and we've got a dirtier, more dangerous, and more expensive service as a result. It takes longer now to go from London to Birmingham on the train than it does to go from where I'm sitting in the House of Commons to the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And it's only 110 miles from London to Birmingham. We've had a whole series of railway disasters caused by people cutting corners to save costs, to make more profits. We've had delays that would make your hair stand on end, people in the depths of winter being delayed 5-7 hours on railway journeys. And we have rolling stock, which has not improved since the public sector days.
Turn the mic on. We're talking with George Galloway, Member of Parliament for the United Kingdom, and just recently re-elected, actually. He had left the Labour Party and started his own one-person party, or presumably there was others with him, and stood for re-election during this last election, and won, and beat the Labour candidate, and he's back in Parliament, and he's the fellow who came over here and told Norm Coleman what he thought of him. We'll come back with more of George Galloway at the bottom of the hour in 10 minutes from now. This is Tom Hartmann with you, the Tom Hartmann radio program, exposing the con in conservative 5 days a week, right here.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. We pause our playing of this morning's my interview this morning with George Galloway, the member of the British Parliament. Our exclusive interview with George Galloway to bring you Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. We'll get back to Mr. Galloway. What would you call it? Parliamentarian Galloway at the bottom of the hour. Hey, Alan.
Hi. Well, we'll start out with a little perhaps nail in Mr. DeLay's coffin. The Texans for a Republican majority called Trump PAC was essentially given a big fine today by the Texas State Judge Joseph Hart. He said they violated campaign laws and they got over $500,000 in corporate money that they did not account for. And he awarded $200,000 in damages to five Democrats who lost their elections because of this.
Wow.
Now, of course, the question is how much of this was DeLay involved with, and how much can they track to DeLay. So that's the hottest news coming out of Washington right now. A couple other interesting things. The debate is going on right now about Bolton and his possible position as our ambassador to the United Nations. And the energy bill. Now, this is very interesting. I was just at a briefing, and unfortunately, I'm not the world expert on energy, but that bipartisan group in the Senate, which is very different than the House, has come up with a energy bill that they say is really quite bipartisan. Now, there's some good parts about it and some bad parts.
And some bad, some Democratic parts and some Republican parts.
That's right. Maria Cantwell, who's your neighboring senator, said, well, it was better than the status quo. It was a good floor to begin with. The House bill, she said, is below the floor.
Yeah.
It does allow offshore drilling. I don't think ANWR is on there, but they didn't say one way or the other, and they, before they got to my question, they ended things. They are doing quite a bit in terms of trying to do alternative forms of energy. The Senate bill bars market manipulation in the way that happened with Enron. Apparently the House bill does not. So
interesting.
We'll see what happens when it gets to the overall floor and what happens on that front. There is apparently $3.75 billion, almost $4 billion, over the next 5 years for research in terms of hydrogen fuel cells, et cetera. And what's interesting, of course, is we know the $3.75 billion is not even 1 month in Iraq.
Right. Amazing. Oh, by the way, I wanted to give you a news scoop. You know George Galloway, the guy who...
Oh, yes. Interviewed him, I just
I interviewed him this morning for 25 minutes, and he said that Al Gore was the legal president of the United States, that George Bush stole the election. He said that George Bush should be prosecuted for war crimes, but that he won't because he has enough power to prevent it, and he used the example of Henry Kissinger. He warned us. He said, I want to warn Americans about the dangers of privatization, and talked about the rail system and the hospital system there. I pointed out to him that Bill Frist's family has made billions by privatizing hospitals, and he's like, yep, and that's, you know, he said, in Great Britain we have a joke. If you call the ambulance, the first thing they check on you is your wallet. And it's quite an interview. It's right now on the homepage of 620kpoj.com, of the AM 620 KPOJ. The web is www.620kpoj.com. And within a few hours, I'll have it on tomhartman.com, the whole thing.
Well, that's great, and maybe we'll try and steal it and put
it
on.
Yeah, do it. There are some incredible sound bites in there that I would like to see you spread as far and wide as you can.
Well, we're good at spreading sound bites.
Yeah, he came after these guys. I mean, it was just like his testimony before the Senate. It wasn't the same words, but it was, actually, he went even beyond the things that he said before the Senate.
Well, just if you can and you want to, just maybe move your TV monitor and those listening as you're listening to your show, because they're now doing the quorum call on the nomination of Bolton.
Oh, interesting.
So,
this is the beginning of the vote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Okay.
If something breaks in the next 25, 30 minutes, feel free to call and let us know, eh?
Will do.
Thanks a lot, Ellen. Good talking to you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com. Always great to hear from Ellen. It's a Tom Hartman program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to listen to the rest of George Galloway here. It's just another 4 or 5 minutes. And then if you'd like to call in, if you have comments, thoughts on it, feel free. Our number 1-866-889-8894, of course. And you can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. George Galloway, he was speaking of privatization. I had asked him about privatization, and he was talking about how in Great Britain, the privatization of the railroads has been a disaster. The point that I keep making over and over again, you wouldn't want the government making your shoes. You don't want the government running your restaurant. But on the other hand, to turn over to private industry, who has as their sole, you know, by law, their sole obligation to make a profit, to turn over to them things that have to do with our safety, our livelihood, our ability to survive in the world, is insanity. It's insanity. It's Republican insanity, but it's insanity. George Galloway on this topic and others.
What's happening is that we're giving a huge state subsidies to private owners who are putting it in their pockets.
Yeah.
Now, we are the only country in the whole world that privatized our air traffic control space. Even the United States did not do that.
We're talking about it here.
Yes, you're talking about it. Mr. Blair was ahead of you. He was ahead of Mrs. Thatcher, who wouldn't have dreamt of any such reckless measure. And we've now handed over control of our air traffic control space to people whose primary responsibility, whose very legal and fiduciary duty, is to use their investment to make a profit for their shareholders. That's got to be legally their first priority, to make a profit for their shareholders. Now, just like an equally deadly privatization, though it doesn't sound like it, it might sound banal. When we privatized the cleaning services in hospitals, we immediately passed on to companies a duty not primarily to keep the hospitals clean, but primarily to make a profit for their shareholders. The result has been an explosion, a veritable explosion in reinfection rates, so-called MRSA, which is a kind of superbug mutant,
right. Yeah.
Which is actually killing 10,000 people a year in Britain. And there are many hospitals, including the one in my own constituency, miscalled the Royal London Hospital, though you'd never find a member of the royal family in it, I can assure you, where you're as likely to come out sick as you are to come out cured because the state of the cleaning services in the hospitals. And that's directly linked to the privatization of that service. So I say to the people of the United States, that the rest of the world is falling out of love with privatization. Some things are too important to be left to the private sector. And just as some things are too important or specialized to be left to the public sector. Nobody's saying that every cafe or fish and chip shop on the corner should be owned by the state. That would be absurd. But there are some things, like air traffic control, like national railway networks, like the cleaning of hospitals, like the teaching of our children in schools, which are too important to be left to people who are doing it for profit.
Well said. And in fact, Senator Bill Frist, the fellow who's leading the United States Senate now, his family fortune was built on hospitals, previously public hospitals being made private. And we're seeing the consequences of that in the United States, exploding health care costs and other
yes.
problems.
Well, we say here, it might be a little unfair, we say here if you fall down in the street in the United States, the ambulance man must feel for your wallet before he feels for your pulse.
Yeah, and to some extent it actually is true. Well, my last question for you is sort of a two-part here. I know you have to get back to the work that you're doing, and I very much appreciate your spending this time with us, sir.
Oh, you're welcome.
First of all, Senator Norm Coleman, whose committee you testified before and to whom you spoke the week before last, as I recall, or last week recently, there are reports, which I've been unable to absolutely confirm, but apparently from the searches of the Senate website, it looks like your testimony has disappeared from the Senate record.
That's right.
Do you know about that, and what are your thoughts on that?
It has been airbrushed from the record. And in a way, if you saw the testimony, you'll know why. because what I managed to do, and I thank God for the breath that he gave me to do it, was blow away the smokescreen that these people are trying to throw up to divert attention from the very real crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors that they themselves are responsible for. And I've had, and I'm not exaggerating this, more than 12,000 emails from the United States. 12,000 emails. And it's not easy in the United States to find out the email address of a British parliamentarian.
Yeah.
And these people have all written to me. Many of them have drawn attention to the fact that although for one day, just 24 hours, my testimony was on the website, it has now been wiped off it. And that tells you all you need to know, really, about the quality of the commitment to democracy and open government that these people really have, as opposed to the talk that they talk.
Well, and finally, with regard to democracy, what do you see the problem with the new laws? We're debating enhancing, actually, the so-called Patriot Act here in the United States. I know you have these kinds of things going on in the UK. The curtailment of freedoms, the loss of liberties in the wake of 9/11. I'm assuming that you've probably seen the Power of Nightmares, the BBC documentary, which nobody in the United States has seen. Do you think that these changes are necessary or useful, or what's your opinion of this?
Well, I'm afraid I'm an advocate of the great Dr. Johnson, the English man of letters, who said that patriotism was the last refuge of the scoundrel. He didn't mean, of course, the patriotism which is a noble, genuine love for the what's best about your country and its beauty and its achievements and so on. But those who wrap themselves in flags and blow the tinny trumpet of patriotism as a means of fooling the people, as a means of getting them to fall in behind the colors and march off to ignoble wars. Wars of conquest, wars of aggression, wars for exploitation. And that's what I think this Patriot Act is all about. It's about fooling the American people into believing that if you just arm the state with enough fly swats, you'll be able to whack away all the beasts that are coming your way. But if the truth is, these mosquitoes are coming out of a swamp, a very real swamp of grievance, of bitterness and hatred at our injustice and at the policies that we are following. And unless we drain that swamp by reversing the policies of injustice that have germinated this threat, then it doesn't matter how many Patriot Acts you pass, doesn't matter how many fly swats you hand out, how many mosquito nets you wrap yourself in, you're not going to be able to stop them hurting us again.
Yeah, well said. Mr. George Galloway, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
I do appreciate it. I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much for being
here
on the Tom Hartman program. The Honorable George Galloway, Member of Parliament of the United States, or the United Kingdom, excuse me. Meanwhile, we discover, as George Galloway points out, the problems with... You know, I'm at a lack of what to call it. I don't want to say the United States, because I don't believe that the majority of Americans in their wildest dreams would say, yes, we should build concentration camps, we should put people in them without access to courts, we should ignore and rip up the Constitution, we should say that the Constitution is quaint, or that the Geneva Conventions are quaint. I can't believe that the majority of Americans would... in their wildest dreams, go along with what this White House has done, and I'm reluctant to even refer to it as the Bush administration because there's having read now the Conyers report, I don't think that they should be called an administration, but I don't have a better word, so I guess I'll for the moment I'll call it the Bush administration. By the way, if you want to read the Conyers report, and I strongly recommend you do it. It's now out as a book called, and it's 126 pages. You can read it in an afternoon. It's called What Went Wrong in Ohio, with a foreword by Gore Vidal. And I highly recommend you check it out. This is the commission by Congressman John Conyers. But today in the New York Times, Amnesty International accused the Bush administration on Wednesday of condoning, quoting Amnesty International, atrocious, end quote, human rights violations, thereby diminishing its moral authority and setting a global example encouraging abuse by other nations. Atrocious.
We used to be the beacon of liberty for the world. I mean, you go back to the late 80s when the students marched into Tiananmen Square. Was it 89, as I recall? I'm sorry, I don't remember the year. But in any case, when the students marched into Tiananmen Square, 30,000 people there, you know, over the course of several months, it had been millions. But that fateful day, 30,000 people confronted the tanks. And many of them were killed, many of them were arrested, many of them lost their ability to make a living, their livelihoods, they were sent off to re-education camps, their families were destroyed, their homes were taken, because they stood up for freedom and democracy in China. In China, in the business partner of Walmart, they stood up, and not just Walmart, they stood up for freedom and democracy. And we did not back them up. We did not say, we stand with you. We did not say, and, you know, Bill Clinton was president at the time. We did not say, we're here to help you. Of course, it would have been suicide to do so. It would have risked a nuclear war. But still, at least some language, please, a little rhetoric. And as these people were marching into Tiananmen Square, in some cases to their deaths, they were carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché replica of the Statue of Liberty. They were quoting Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, America's probably arguably two most famous liberals. Quoting Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, carrying the Statue of Liberty in communist China, facing down the tyrants, giving their lives for the ideal of liberty. And now who are they going to quote? Do you really think that people in China looking for liberty are going to be looking to the United States any longer? Unfortunately, what we're discovering is that by the millions, by the tens of millions, perhaps by the hundreds of millions, they're looking to Osama bin Laden. They're looking to radical Islam because they're seeing, unfortunately, tragically, they're seeing that this administration is the tool of big business, period, that our foreign policy has been driven by profits for Halliburton and profits for the oil industry, and make no mistake about it, they are incredibly profitable. The defense industry, it is beyond imagination. To 5 years ago, it would have been considered beyond imagination to say, someday in America, by the way, let me tell you, someday in America or someday in the world, people are going to look at America and they're going to say, no, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to live in a country, people are going to say someday in the future, I don't want to live in a country where you're one paycheck away from bankruptcy, and where if you get sick, you can't get help. Or if you're one of 45 million people, that's one out of six Americans. If you're one-sixth of the population, then, you know, the only kind of help that you can get is going to an overcrowded emergency room in an urban hospital and waiting, in some cases, as much as a day to see somebody, and then, you know, well, we'll do our best to deal with something that should have been dealt with back when it was treatable, back when it was preventable. The people will be terrified that they're living literally one paycheck away from economic disaster. That the federal police agency would go before Congress and argue that there should not be judges involved in deciding when they can go into people's homes, when they can ask for people's papers, when they can investigate people's lives, when they can hold people accountable. Can you imagine? I mean, I suspect that everybody listening to this can remember just 5 years ago when we wouldn't have imagined such a thing. We would have said, come on, you're talking about the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union. You're talking about communist China. You can't be talking about America.
America? America would never do that. Which is why I say, I don't think that America did this. I think Bush Jr. did this. Much to our detriment. I think Karl Rove did this. His modern-day Svengali, or his Goebbels, did this. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota, on the line. Hey, Tom.
Oop.
Let me turn up the volume on you here. There you go. Now you're
okay.
On.
Remember, it's autocratic communist China.
Yeah. Okay.
You are
my word police here, and I appreciate it. I use your stuff. You know, you noticed yesterday the guy with Marty Fishgold from the ILCA that I was promoting your democracy in the workplace, and I continue to promote it. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I actually called up the number and left a message, a voicemail on Alex voicemail to get on that slogan. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Although Marty's really the guy I think who has the ability to make the decisions. Alex is a good guy and does important work with ILCA, but I think that the decisions about the ultimate decision about slogans and things, it's going to be Marty or it's going to be their board of directors. So
okay.
You talk to the right guy.
The reason I'm calling today, I was listening at lunchtime to O'Reilly real quick, and you know how I like, of course, to focus on definitions of the words that they distort and shove them right back down their throat to expose their hypocrisy.
Right.
And this substitute guy, guest host, he was talking about the winner of American Idol represented the red states, the W voters, because she chose a song about freedom. And the loser, the long-haired hippie guy, was a smoking leftist, blue stater, pot-smoking leftist, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I called in, I said, I want to challenge you on your theory. I said, I'm looking here in my dictionary under the word liberal and leftist, and it says, those professing political views marked by desire to reform the established order and give greater freedom to the common man. I said, actually, the blue staters are all about freedom. What are you talking about? And he was just, well, what's your point? I said, my point is...
Good one, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're so rich, that is Cheney, billionaires from Bush and Cheney. We can't give you the stars and the moon.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush and Cheney.
Can't they guess? It's a way to hedge our bets that the winner will dance to our tune. Sing, hey, by a candidate today.
Yes, indeed, by a candidate today. Welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Now it's official. It wasn't Newsweek who was saying that the Quran was desecrated. It is the FBI. It's the U.S. military. Guantanamo Bay Prison, terror suspects at the Guantanamo Bay Prison told U.S. interrogators as early as April of 2002... just 3 months after the first detainees arrived, that military guards abused them and desecrated the Quran, declassified FBI records say. Turns out, Newsweek was right. The statements about guards disrespecting the Quran echo public allegations made many months later by some detainees and their lawyers after prisoners released from prison. I mean, after all, if they're going to smear phony menstrual blood on these people, if they're going to, you know, pile them into pyramids, attack them with dogs, you know, cover them with their own feces. You think they're not going to take a book and toss it in the slop bucket that they use for a toilet? Come on. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894. It's amazing how the cons, the right-wing noise machine, has been able to whip this thing up to the point where Newsweek is walking around with their head cowed. It's like, you know, how dare you take on this administration? Well, I suspect that these are, you know, you're going to see the media start fighting back. Armin in Florida, maybe you have some thoughts on this, Armin. What's up?
Yeah, I have some thoughts. George Bush believes so much in privatization that he used the public's treasury and the public's finance military to illegally invade Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it starts with his using the public's money to build a stadium in Texas and then moves on.
For millionaires.
Yeah.
For millionaires.
Yeah.
Where's the personal responsibility? If millionaires can't build their own stadiums, then why shouldn't all of us have everything that they get free from the government?
Yeah, well said, Armin, well said. Thank you very much for calling in. I do appreciate it. Always good to hear from you. It's and it's so true. I mean, this is it. You know, Bush, well, I don't need to go off on that rant. You know the drill. You know what's going on with this guy. He is becoming so transparent. The American people are waking up. It's why his popularity or his job approval ratings are below 50% now. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Kareth for coming in and engineering the program, to Louise for producing it, to you for calling in. Thanks to George Galloway for being a guest. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up and the folks who are streaming our program. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.